Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
G'day, welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this program, Dr. David Brewster and Rick Smith join Professor Rory Medcalf to explore what a deeper Australia-Bangladesh security relationship could and should look like. David, Senior Research Fellow at the National Security College, has authored our latest policy options paper titled New Indo-Pacific Partnership, Building Australia-Bangladesh Security Ties. And Rick, former Australian Ambassador to China and Indonesia and Secretary of Defence, is the author of a compelling working paper from the college titled Forgotten Friends, Australia, India and the Independence of Bangladesh. Links to both these papers are available in the show notes. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. Now let's get into it.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, the head of the National Security College, and it's a particular pleasure today to welcome two guests who are going to take Australian foreign and security policy in a direction that I guess we don't travel as often as we should, and that is not only turning to the Indian Ocean, but looking at a partnership with a nation where Australia has probably undervalued, underdeveloped its equities over the years. That's all changing, and that country is Bangladesh. My colleagues on the program today are Dr. David Brewster, who is a senior research fellow here at the National Security College and has deep expertise not only on Indo-Pacific strategic issues but particularly on the Indian Ocean and has looked at Bangladesh and a number of the other partners Australia is getting more interested in that part of the world. But I also am pleased to welcome back to the college Rick Smith. Rick Smith is a distinguished Australian foreign and defence policy official with vast expertise, having been Secretary of the Department of Defence, ambassador to, I can't keep up how many countries, Rick, you've been ambassador to, but China, Indonesia, a number of key partnerships for Australia. A really important friend and supporter of the work we do at the National Security College and a really veteran Australian diplomat. And now, as you would call yourself, Rick, a retired citizen of this this parish of Canberra. But it's great to have you both on the program.
Thanks.
And I think that we'll start with you, David, because I want to look at the new research that you've done for the National Security College that marks not only the fact that this is actually the 50th year of the independence of Bangladesh, and we'll come back to that in a moment, because I know, Rick, that's something that resonates with your career. But, David, your paper published under the Policy Options paper series of the National Security College and out now in June 2021, your paper really challenges Australian security thinking. It looks beyond the great power politics of the Indo-Pacific. It looks beyond the United States and China. It looks beyond the very ambitious relationship we have with India, and it puts Bangladesh on the map for Australia. Why did you write this paper, David?
Thanks very much, Rory. It's great to be here. Look, I think the starting point is really understanding the Indo-Pacific as a region, as a multipolar region. So in saying that, we're not just talking about what key powers such as the United States, China and India are doing, but there's a whole range of middle powers, if you want to call them that, And that means that Australia's strategy towards the Indo-Pacific has to be about engaging with all the middle powers in the Indo-Pacific just as much as dealing with the big powers. And the defence strategic update that came out last year really focused in on this and talked about how within the Indo-Pacific we have an immediate region which we have to be giving priority to, and that immediate region comes in three parts: the Pacific Islands, Southeast Asia, and the Northeast Indian Ocean. And it's quite apparent from anyone who follows the region that we really have a bit of a gaping hole in terms of our relationships and engagement in the Northeast Indian Ocean. Yes, we've focused on India for more than a decade as a key strategic partner, absolutely. But there's a number of other smaller countries in that region that we have very little engagement with in the security space. And when I say smaller...
It's all relative, right?
It's relative. I mean, Bangladesh has a population of more than 160 million people. So it's a little embarrassing to call it a smaller country, but it certainly is smaller than India. And it's a country that has incredible economic success over the last 20 years, but it also comes with risks. And so it's a country that we should be seriously looking at engaging with.
So your paper, it seems to be partly about breaking the mindset in some of the world about what Bangladesh is all about these days. And of course, going to its history, going to its founding, its independence during a really brutal period of history, its experience with poverty and with resource pressures and so forth. There are stereotypes and myths out there about the old Bangladesh. Your paper really puts paid to some of those. I mean, what is this country that Australia seeks to engage? What's in it for Australia?
Well, look, absolutely. And it's had a very difficult history with its liberation in 1971, which I think Rick will talk about a little bit later. And it has more than its fair share of natural disasters and the like. But the extraordinary thing when you look at Bangladesh is its resilience and its economic success. And indeed, it's been the most economically successful of any country in South Asia over the last 20 years or so. And
sorry, that's a surprise to some listeners. What do you mean by that? Is it growth rates? Is it living standards?
Well, it's over a whole range of things. In terms of GDP growth rates, it's had extended GDP growth of more than 8% per annum for an extended period up till the COVID crisis. And probably even more importantly, it has among the best social indicators of any country in South Asia in terms of women's rights, in terms of health, and public education. It's really an extraordinary and unsung success story. And from Australia's standpoint, it's following an economic development model that is very familiar to us. It's an economic development model that is very similar to some of the East Asian tigers that we've seen over the previous decades. And indeed, I think that it's really on track to become the next big Asian economic tiger.
So I'm going to take us a little bit from the here and now and the promise of the future. And I want to come back to you a bit later, David, to get some specificity around, what should Australia do in this security relationship. But let's come back to those nuts and bolts. And I want to look at how the past connects with the present. So, Rick, this is a good moment to bring you into the conversation. And I should just note for our listeners that although we're publishing a new paper by David Brewster, we're also taking advantage of this opportunity to revive a really fantastic publication the college put out several years ago. And Rick, you are the author of that. And so I want to use that as a starting point to take you back, if you like, to 1971 and your paper that you wrote for us, Forgotten Friends, Australia, India and the Independence of Bangladesh, published by the National Security College in 2016, tells a story that resonates for Australians, I think for Australian foreign policy to this day. Rick, what was your paper about? What's the experience that you relate in this?
Thanks, Rory. Yes, I was in the Australian High Commission in New Delhi during this time and observed the end of this unusual marriage. The Pakistan that was created following the partition of Greater India in 1947 comprised two wings, the west, of course, Punjab, Sindh, Balochistan, the northwest frontier and so on, and on the other side of India, Bengal, all these two parties had in mind, East and West, all they had in common was the religion of Islam, and otherwise they were just very different. And West Pakistan was determined to dominate this marriage, as it were. It was always at risk. It was never going to be sustainable in the long term. Two wings separated by thousands of kilometres of hostile India. The pity is that it had to end in such tragedy, and it did, following an election in which the leadership in West Pakistan of military leadership wouldn't recognise an outcome which effectively gave East Pakistan a majority in its parliament. And so out of all this, there became a declaration of independence led by Mujibur Rahman and a civil war into which India intervened late in the peace after about 8 months of civil war, by which time some 10 million Bengalis had fled into India to avoid the war. India intervened and secured the independence of West Bengal, which then became Bangladesh. And Australia, uncharacteristically differing from the United States, from Europe, certainly from China, throughout all of this, was sympathetic to India's position with 10 million displaced people on their borders and sympathetic as well to the movement towards independence in Bangladesh because it had seemed to us very clear from the beginning of the year that that this was the only way it was going to end. There was a momentum towards independence that was not to be resisted. We'd made that judgment in February. Eventually, it was settled in December when the independence of Bangladesh was achieved through following the Indian military intervention. And Australia was one of the very first countries to recognise the newly independent state of Bangladesh, way out in front of Europe and the United States, and certainly from China again. So we had a particular connection there, and we were fortunate to have, as the Deputy High Commissioner, as he'd been and went on to become the High Commissioner, a man named Jim Allen, who was a Bengali speaker, had been born in East Bengal through all that period before the Second World War, in fact. And Jim was well anchored in the state and a friend of Mujibur Rahman, who became the first president and then prime minister.
Personal connections mattered in diplomacy then. I guess they still do. But you had the extraordinary experience of being sort of up close to a lot of this as a young diplomat on your first posting.
Yes.
Maybe you could share a little insight into that experience and what you saw that perhaps helped shape Australia's policy.
We were putting out a lot of aid to India to help it support the refugee or displaced people's camps, and I went down to Calcutta and then up around into the northeast to see how this was all working. The RAAF was flying in housing and plastic supplies to provide shelter for people, food and medicine and so on, and I was sent down there to have a look at that and see how it was going. Then I was up in Tripura, a state on the border between Bangladesh, as it now is, and Burma. Population 900,000, and at that time, in late June of 1971, there were 1 million displaced people, so they're all living in the streets and everywhere. I went down to the border in a taxi and saw what the Pakistan army was doing. It was firing shell-burst mortar into crowds of people as they were trying to flee across the border. and before my eyes, two young kids, I suppose they were 8 and 6 or 7 and 5 or something, were struck by pieces of shrapnel. And I put them in my taxi, and their parents with them, and they were in a distressed state, took them back into this hospital, which was just packed with people, you know, lying, you know, foot to head in the corridors and so on, and left them there. I've often wondered what I took the pieces of shrapnel out of them. I hope that was all right medically, and have kept them. But I just hope those kids survived. And the remarkable thing was that. They were there presumably through December into the war, but by January they started to go back, and within a month or two of Bangladesh's independence, almost all of the 10 million were back. It was an extraordinary movement of people over a period of 12 months. And so the new Bangladesh emerged, and Mujib had been the leader. He became the prime minister.
So there's so much we can draw from that story, from that, I guess, that experience that your paper recounts, Rick. And of course, just for our listeners, there's a really detailed and I think very, very comprehensive version of the paper that you published with the Australian Institute of International Affairs,
yes.
More of a substantial essay. So our short paper is kind of a way into that.
Yep.
But in terms of the big lessons for policy and for the interests of nations and so on, beyond the sort of the really confronting, I guess, human dimension that that you witnessed and experienced, I mean, this was a moment, as I read it, where Australia demonstrated what we'd like to call an independent foreign policy. We were an early mover. It wasn't necessarily what our American friends wanted. It wasn't what our future and perhaps past Chinese friends wanted. It was something distinctly Australian. What do you think the importance of that that diplomatic stance of Australia is looking back?
Well, it was certainly important at the time. We were taking a position very different from that of the United States. We were still engaged with them, of course, in Vietnam. But we took a very distinct position here. The United States was hostage to Pakistan because they were using Pakistan as the conduit to China and the Nixon-Kissinger opening up and so on. But we took a very different view, and we made it clear to the United States that we were doing that and why, and there were no repercussions. That was understood in Washington. We went about our business. What I explored subsequently was why did we take a position so different from that of everyone else, and that's for another day. The second point to make, though, is that the position we took was readily acknowledged across Southeast Asia in particular. And when we announced our recognition of Bangladesh in January of 72, it was widely acclaimed in the region. Australia is serious about the region. They're dealing with us on our merits, and they've engaged this new state so readily. So it reflected not just what you've called an independent foreign policy, but an engagement with the region, a prioritising of the Asia, Southeast Asia region in our foreign policy framework. And that was welcomed in the region. Friends who were serving in Singapore and Malaysia recall their host governments putting on parties for us or turning up at parties for us.
Well, I'd like to think it's not completely completely forgotten, and you've certainly, you know, alerted us to the importance of that episode from Australia's diplomatic history. I know that when we published your paper, we had friends and colleagues in Bangladesh who certainly took an interest, but in India as well. I think it it resounds well to Australia's profile today during this extremely challenging time in our foreign and security policy. And I'm not going to draw comparisons necessarily with then and now, but I might jump forward to the present and the future again, if I may, and I might turn back to David on that and would love your views as well in a moment, Rick. But David, looking at your paper, how do you think Bangladesh today imagines Australia as a potential partner? You know, would we be knocking on an open door if we took the steps that your paper advocates?
Yes, absolutely, we would be knocking on an open door. Bangladesh, as we were talking about before, has been incredibly successful over the last couple of decades in terms of their economic development. But increasingly, they're finding themselves squeezed between some of the major powers. It's obviously right next door to India. It's very close to China. And it's very much feeling the pressures of that major power competition. And as a result, it's really reaching out to other important countries in the region that it could become important partners in terms of economic engagement, political engagement, and security engagement. And so I think it is very much an open door for us. We have a lot of interests in that part of the world that both positive and negative. I've mentioned the potential for economic partnership and trade and investment. But there are also risks. There are risks from violent extremism, from climate change, for example. So there's been a study showing that a rise of 1 meter in sea levels would inundate around 17% of Bangladesh territory, displacing perhaps more than 15 million people. So we have to be concerned about that and ready to react to that if that happens. Importantly, we're also seeing in Myanmar a slow slide into civil conflict. Who knows where that will end, but almost certainly it will have consequences for the entire region, whether it be in terms of people smuggling, drug smuggling, a whole lot of other potential risks for Australia. So we have to be engaged with the region. We need friends in that part of the world, friends that are happy to work with us. And I think that certainly Bangladesh has given every indication that they're looking for a closer partnership with Australia.
I'll come back to some of that because the question to my mind is still a little bit what's in it for Australia. But let's turn firstly to some of the more specific things, steps that should be taken. It's very easy to say we need better relations with country X, we need better economic relations or security relations. What are some of the practical steps that you would advocate the Australian government take in the near future?
Yeah. Well, look, it's frankly starting from a very low base in terms of defence and security engagement. It's an extremely thin relationship at the moment. So there's an awful lot of low-hanging fruit that can be grasped at a relatively low cost. So, for example, just as a starting point, we have no a defence advisor on the ground there in Bangladesh. And this is in a country where the military plays a very significant role in public affairs. So if nothing else, we need to have that sort of immediate engagement or ability to engage directly with the Bangladesh military. But there's a whole lot of other things, again, relatively low cost. I mean, I would put them in two categories. One is in terms of building personal relationships between the Australian and Bangladesh military. And the other is assisting Bangladesh build their capabilities in areas that are of particular direct interest to Australia. So we want to see Bangladesh being able to better control its own maritime spaces, control population movements, drug smuggling that might be happening in the region. And Australia has particular expertise in that area that we can share with our Bangladesh partners, again, at relatively low cost. It's not about giving them donating equipment or the like. It's about sharing expertise and building partnerships.
We'll be back after this short break.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Now, the Australian Navy is not a stranger to that part of the world so much anymore. The Indo-Pacific Endeavour task group was there, I think, a couple of years ago in the Bay of Bengal, and, you know, one hopes to see them back there before long. But at a Navy-to-Navy level, or whether it's other services, what specifics would you see?
Okay, well, to start with, the Bangladesh military is highly professional. Very much is comes from the British model. So there is a shared military culture, if you like, particularly in the Navy, and there's a lot of scope for secondments, whether it be between the Australian and Bangladesh military colleges. Bangladesh also has particular expertise in peacekeeping, where they're one of the largest contributors to UN peacekeeping operations throughout the world. They are really at the forefront in terms of addressing women, peace and security issues. They're a co-sponsor of a UN resolution regarding that. And to the extent that Australia is going to be working in the peacekeeping space in coming years, we actually have quite a lot to learn from Bangladesh. But as I said, there are also a number of areas that we can be working with them to assist them in the maritime security space. And it's not just the Defence Department and our military services, but there's also a lot of other Australian government agencies that can be engaging, whether it be through in terms of search and rescue, or helping them to address port security issues, or engagement between the AFP and their counterparts in Bangladesh. As I said, it's got to be a whole of government engagement, but a targeted one as well, in areas where we see particular direct interests.
But, you know, our resources are stretched thin, you'd argue, sort of a so-called middle power with this broad Indo-Pacific interest that we have trouble, if you like, servicing on our own. You know, I'd note that separately, of course, that Australia's drawing down elsewhere, Afghanistan and so forth. What's in it for us? I'd like to get your views on that, David, and then, Rick, I'd be very interested in your response on the logic of David's proposal.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the Northeast Indian Ocean is an area that the Defence Strategic Update said was a priority area. It's one of the three elements of our immediate region, and it's the part of our immediate region where we have the least engagement or defence presence. Part of Australia's Indo-Pacific strategy, I suppose, has been to remove defence resources from the Middle East and West Asia, and that includes most recently Afghanistan, and move them closer to home. And that includes applying at least a small part of those resources into the Northeast Indian Ocean. In terms of strategic competition, it's becoming an increasingly contested area between China, India, and the United States. We're going to be seeing that in Myanmar over coming years, as Myanmar becomes a bit of a battleground, I think, between some of the major powers. Bangladesh is also feeling the squeeze, and only a week or two ago, the Chinese ambassador to Bangladesh really made quite an extraordinary statement, an explicit threat to the Bangladesh government that it would face consequences if the Bangladesh government formed relationship with the Quad countries. And that was really an extraordinary statement. And really, to my mind, indicative of how little the Chinese Communist Party understands Bangladesh and the Bangladesh people, because that's not something that the Bangladesh people, having liberated themselves and, you know, faced many natural disasters, would take lying down. I think that's really quite an extraordinary statement for them to make.
So I take it there's a context of managing the, if you like, the power relationships in the region, managing or somehow moderating China's power and influence that's partly on your mind when it comes to this proposal.
Yes, I think really Bangladesh and Australia are looking for, I suppose you could call it ballast in our regional relationships. So it's not just about what the major powers are doing, but all of the middle powers of the Indo-Pacific have just as much a stake in the region, and I think increasingly will work together to try and mitigate some of the worst effects of strategic competition.
Rick, what do you think about David's proposal? How would you approach this?
Rory, I think David has done an extraordinarily good job at setting out Australia's interests in Bangladesh, both our bilateral interests and our interests relating to Bangladesh in terms of its place in the geostrategic environment. And I think all of that is quite relevant. I would simply add that there are economic opportunities there too. I don't know what the numbers are post-COVID or indeed how COVID pandemic has affected Bangladesh, but certainly before then, economic growth was impressive and the country was bidding to become the newest tiger, to use old-fashioned language, and yet our trade is quite minimal. Presumably into the future, as they develop a stronger manufacturing base, it'll be a market for resources, but as well it ought to be a market for agricultural produce. So I would just add that footnote. That said, this is important, I think, to understand. You can't approach these relationships in a transactional way. Mm. You can't say, what's in it for us today? You can't.
I can as a podcast host, yeah. But I think I agree. As a policymaker,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You've got to say, if you want to say, all right, let's put in a defence advisor, a defence attaché, let's invest in a defence relationship, let's have a naval visit, and 2 years from now this will be markedly different. It won't be. You're in it for the very long haul. I think that's one of the reasons for starting now rather than postponing any longer. But it isn't to be transactional. You have to see it in that longer-term picture. I think that on the other point that David sensibly raised, that is of defence resources, there are two things happening there. One is post-Afghanistan. There are going to be resources, you would hope, and anyway we've withdrawn our defence attaché, I think, from Myanmar. So there's a spare body, if you like. But on the bigger picture sense, I used to say when I was Secretary in Defence, our budget then was $26 billion. I used to say, with a workforce of 100,000 and a budget of $26 billion, we can actually do anything at all in the area of small change, and that's what this would be. So I don't think there's a resource argument against doing this. There may be a resource argument in terms of how and where you use the Navy at any one time, because deploying ships to one area means they're not in another area and there are trade-offs like that. But in terms of personnel and bringing people to Australia for training, I do believe we can afford that.
So before we wrap up, I want to take the conversation a little wider on a couple of points. I want to look at the role of these, if you like, middle player partnerships in the bigger Indo-Pacific. David, you've done some work with the National Security College on a project, in fact, a project supported by the Australian Defence Department, the Made for Multipolarity project, where we look at, you know, the many potential partners for Australia, particularly in the Indian Ocean. So I'd be interested also in looking at how you'd see, for example, Bangladesh fitting in that bigger picture, and who else is in that wider picture beyond the Quad, beyond India?
Thanks, Roy. So really for the last 2 years, the National Security College has been looking at Australia's strategic engagement, particularly in the Indian Ocean region. with the mind to understanding how Australia can better engage with a range of players, the middle powers, but even some of the small countries in the region. And the Indian Ocean is an area where historically we haven't had strong defence relationships, unlike, say, Southeast Asia or the Pacific. And it's, so it's an area that we need to look at and understand who our partners are. Obviously, the starting point for any of that is India, and India is and will be our key strategic partner in the Indian Ocean region. There's no doubt about that. But there's a whole lot of other important relationships that we need to be looking at to complement our relationship with India and provide us with alternatives as well. So, for example, in Southeast Asia, we don't just have a relationship with Indonesia, as important as it is. We have a relationship with a range of other countries. And so it should be in the Indian Ocean region. So other countries include Sri Lanka. It's another key partner for the future, but also some of the small island states. As small as they may be, they have their own views about their own future, and they have their own desires to be engaging with countries like Australia. So we need to see an enhanced partnership with Bangladesh, not only in itself, but as part of a broader engagement with a number of other countries within the Indian Ocean region.
I have to challenge you, though. I mean, we've put a lot of effort into the relationship with India, and I think all three of us, you, me and Rick, each in our way, have wanted to see that relationship flourish. Won't India find it a little strange that Australia is pursuing this relationship with, for example, Bangladesh? I mean, is there a risk that that will detract from what we're trying to do with India long term?
I think it would be the exact opposite. I think our Indian colleagues would be absolutely delighted for us to be engaging with some of the states around it. Obviously, we're going to only have a tiny fraction of the resources or attention that India shows to its neighbours, so it's in no way threatening to India's engagement, but it certainly bolsters these relationships as not only with India but also part of our broader Quad relationships. So any engagement that we have with countries like Bangladesh or, for example, Sri Lanka are very much complementary to our relationship with India, and I believe would be seen in quite positive terms in Delhi.
How do you feel about that, Rick?
I'd agree with that. Given the scale of India's relationship engagement with Bangladesh, I think that they would understand readily that anything we would do would be at the margins and not contrary to their interests in any way. Similarly, of course, China has a very big relationship with Bangladesh and they're bound to be trying to grow it. But I wouldn't see us being in a position to contest that relationship. We'll just be an additional and hopefully helpful voice. A voice with a particular Australian perspective, of course, but not one that's challenging anybody else in Dhaka.
Helping to give them a range of alternatives, I guess,
a set of options. And at the same time, I've got to say, we haven't touched on this, but benefiting from a Bangladesh view of the world. Now, you can take that a bit lightly, but don't, because Bangladeshis, Bengalis, very articulate, thoughtful people. They're well represented in world academia, and they have a view or a strategic outlook which is worth listening to. There they are, India, China, Myanmar. They'd be worth listening to at this time, and I hope our High Commission is engaged with them at that level. A defence advisor could complement that.
That's really useful. Before we close, I just need to ask one last sort of perhaps slightly challenging question to both of you, but I'll start with you, David, and that is really this term values that we see a lot in our foreign policy, particularly looking at democratic partners in the Indo-Pacific. And I guess personally would sometimes cast that a little bit differently as suggesting we need to focus on the principles we have in common. But the nature of democracy in Bangladesh, for example, is, you know, it's sometimes questioned, the quality of democracy there. You know, you mentioned yourself the role of the military. So how does your proposal sit with the values dimension of Australian diplomacy in the Indo-Pacific?
Look, I think values can be important in relationships, but it's certainly not the be-all and end-all, and really the key driver for anything that Australia does has to be our interests. I think our interests are quite consistent with those of Bangladesh. It's a democracy. It may not be a perfect democracy, as is the case with many countries in the region, but certainly it's a civilian-led government with where the military plays an important role, and that's just life as it is in our region.
Rick? Rory, when it comes to Australian diplomacy and the conduct of our business, values rate very highly. But we can't be too fussy about where and how we find our friends or the circumstances they're in. If we're going to get fussy in that area, we'll find ourselves with a declining group of friends in this part of the world.
We could take this a lot further, but I think you've put an important idea on the table, David, and I think, Rick, this echoes fascinatingly, I think, with the arc of your diplomatic experience, the fact that an independent Bangladesh, that an India that is taking actions in its own interests but that actually are in the interests of a more multipolar region, all of this seems to have come full circle for Australia in this challenging Indo-Pacific of the 2020s. So it's an important paper, I think, David, that you're putting out there into the policy debate. I'm really pleased that we're able to provide a platform for it, and I hope some debate around it as well. I'm just wondering if either of you have got any sort of final observation before we close the program.
David described the relationship with Bangladesh as a gaping hole. I wouldn't describe it as that. I would say it's a gap, and a gap that we can readily fill to our benefit.
So there's the National Security College putting a few ideas out there in Australia's foreign and strategic policy engagement with the Indo-Pacific. David Brewster, Rick Smith, thank you so much for your time on the National Security Podcast. And you can find both of the papers on the National Security College website. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's all for today. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can find links to both David's and Rick's papers in the show notes. Don't forget to subscribe to the National Security Podcast and give us a rating wherever you listen. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.